The Congressional Super Committee has just 6 days left to come up with cuts.
Will they reach a deal?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org on this Thursday, November 17th.
Coming up, is insider trading if it's being done by a member of Congress?
Apple responds quietly to accusations that its suppliers are major polluters in China.
And who studies the most and least in college?
We're going to find out in just a moment on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Well, here we are just 6 days away from the Congressional Super Committee's deadline to cut $1.2 trillion, Jeremy, from the federal deficit over the next decade. And as Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid put it,
Congress and government generally don't do things until the last minute. The last minute is fast approaching.
And talks remain at a standstill. Diane Swonk is chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She's with us from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Diane, you're in touch with all the big power players in Washington all the time. What's going to happen? Are they going to reach a deal?
Well, right now it doesn't look like it. I still have hope, but not a lot of faith in the fact that they will. But again, I have hope. Usually Congress takes it down to the deadline, and one deadline is actually Monday so that the CBO can score it up before Thanksgiving.
The Congressional Budget Office. And Diane, you know, the last time we had a big deadline like this in Washington, it was the debt ceiling deadline. And of course, that had immediate consequences for inaction. This time, the automatic cuts that would go into effect wouldn't happen until 2013. So does that mean that we don't really need to freak out about this deadline?
Absolutely not. In fact, the market repercussions would be fairly substantial, especially against the backdrop of the debt crisis in Europe. We need to look like we're acting responsibly and moving forward, and we can't afford to continue to look like the Keystone Cops in Congress.
Well, you mentioned Europe. I want to ask you about one thing on that front. This big warning that came yesterday from the ratings agency Fitch, which says that U.S. banks could face big problems because of the debt crisis in Europe. Is that for real, or I thought these banks in the U.S. had reduced their exposure?
Well, we actually have seen the banks in the U.S. voluntarily give their exposure on the sovereign debt crisis, and that was no new news that Fitch announced. They are exposed, but they are much more cushioned than they once were. That said, the Fed has been very vocal about the fact that our banks are in better shape, but let's face it, we're not an island. And if a crisis were to occur in Europe, it still could come back and bite us here in the United States, and that's what was really concerned about at the Federal Reserve. Although our banks are better cushioned than 2008, it doesn't mean we're immune, particularly in money market funds, where they're so exposed to short-term European bank debt.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, when it comes to the super committee, yesterday Democrats leaked an offer that would involve cutting $225 billion from Medicare, the federal health insurance program for senior citizens.
But, Steve, the latest report from the Census Bureau shows that it is, in fact, rising medical costs that have sent the poverty rate for the elderly to almost 16%. For more on this, we're joined by Marketplace Economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So why are the elderly paying more for medical care if they've got Medicare to deal with that?
Same reason you're paying more for medical care, Jeremy. I mean, you have an employer-sponsored health insurance plan. Lots of our listeners do. And yet those costs keep going up. It's rising Medicare premiums. It's higher deductibles, prescription drugs. And for example, Medicare does cover a lot. But for certain services, yeah, there's a 20% copay. And, you know, if you have a bigger bill, that 20% absorbs more of your income.
Well, is poverty among the elderly getting worse at a faster pace than it is for the rest of the population?
Well, this comes out of the new measure to try and get a better understanding of poverty and the dynamics of poverty in our economy. The impact of medical care on the elderly, which, you know, makes sense because if you get older, you know, your body starts to do less well, you get sick more, your eyes deteriorate, your hearing deteriorates. So you spend a lot of money on medical bills, and that's why we saw a doubling, a near doubling of the poverty rate among the elderly, whereas among children, the poverty rate actually shrank because they use less medical services.
Well, why is this happening? This was a big triumph of the New Deal to reduce poverty among the elderly. Why are we moving in the wrong direction now?
Well, I think it really reflects the problems that are embedded in our healthcare system, rising medical inflation, and the trend with the super committee and the atmosphere in Washington is that we have to reduce these benefits. So people are going to be told you have to spend more on your medical care. And my question is, with what money?
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
Well, the Fitch warning, of course, yesterday that Diane mentioned a moment ago, talked about how American banks would take a big hit if the Eurozone crisis gets worse. But just how exposed is the U.S. to what's going on in Europe? From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
Fitch concedes that American banks have been pulling money out of Europe for over a year, especially from the most vulnerable countries like Greece. But the U.S. banks still have a very big exposure to France, and Fitch warns the French could soon be dragged into the crisis. The ratings agencies also worried about the insurance coverage the banks have taken out to protect themselves against losses from a default. Fitch says that coverage may be ineffective. Bob McGee of Independent Strategy says just look at what's happening in Greece.
The Greek government is arranging a voluntary haircut or default with its private sector creditors, which would not invoke what they call a credit event and therefore not invoke the insurance.
Fitch says U.S. banks could suffer in other ways if the Eurozone debt crisis worsens. The money markets, where they raise a lot of cash, could be disrupted. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Hundreds of protesters in the Occupy Wall Street movement gathered this morning in front of the New York Stock Exchange with a goal of at least trying to disrupt the inner workings of what's going on inside the exchange.
Well, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has a firsthand view from Lower Manhattan. She's on the scene. Hey, Stacey.
Hi, Steve.
What's going on over there right now?
Well, it's pretty chaotic. There are marchers and protesters everywhere waving signs. There are hundreds and hundreds of people. It's hard to tell because Lower Manhattan is really dense, so everyone's spread out through the streets. Police barricades are everywhere. There are police in riot gear. There's a lot of noise, as you can hear.
I can definitely hear it, and I know protesters today are calling for a new beginning, Stacey, to the Occupy movement after being thrown out of Zuccotti Park earlier this week. What's at stake?
Today is the two-month anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street movement, and yes, they have been kicked out of Zuccotti Park for all intents and purposes. So I think, you know, what's at stake for the movement right now, people feel like, is momentum. They're either going to lose momentum today or gain it because of the closure of Zuccotti Park. I think a lot of people feel like today the goal is to stop the ringing of the bell at the stock exchange and ring the people's bell instead. So it's quite a symbolic day today for that reason as well.
All right, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith in Lower Manhattan. Stacey, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, we've got more coverage of Occupy Wall Street and the European debt crisis,
the super committee
and the banks and everything else at the all-new marketplace.org.
Hope you've checked out the new website. Of course, there are all kinds of new features there. An easier way, Jeremy, of course, to get the audio that you...
And the new blogs. There are
new
a lot of activity on that website.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. We all know how secretive Apple likes to be, but this week that's causing problems for the company in China, where environmental groups have accused Apple suppliers of major pollution violations. Apple has hired an outside company to look into those charges, but as Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai, Apple isn't saying much.
Apple may be a lot of things, but few would call the company low profile, unless you're talking to Apple about their supply chain. That's what environmentalist Li Li did this week.
They just kept saying, believe us that we will make it work. Our company is low profile. We have our own way of solving problems.
2 months ago, she helped author a report. It alleged the suppliers that are making iPhones and iPads are blatantly violating pollution laws throughout China. She said Apple flew 2 Chinese-speaking members of its supply management team from the U.S. just for this meeting. She's not sure why Apple went to all the trouble, though. She said the only thing they admitted to was the number of suppliers they work with in China.
I am not satisfied at all with what they said. We need them to disclose who their suppliers are. If they are unwilling to do that, then how do we know if they're doing the right thing?
Apple says it provides safe working conditions and uses environmentally responsible manufacturing. But so far, this hasn't held up to public scrutiny. After Apple admitted to poisoning 137 workers at one Chinese plant, it said it was monitoring their health. But several workers later said they had never heard from Apple. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz from Marketplace.
More pressure today on the Syrian government from neighboring countries. The Arab League has given Syria 3 days to end the violence against protesters and allow monitors into that country, or the Arab League will impose heavy economic sanctions. Now, Syria's neighbor, Turkey, has been pushing for a lot of those sanctions, and the BBC's Jonathan Head is with us now from Istanbul. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. What kinds of economic sanctions are being talked about right now, and will they have any impact?
Well, Turkey's in a position to hit the Syrian economy quite hard because it's one of its biggest trading partners. That trade was worth around $2.5 billion last year, much bigger than a few years ago. So they could hit Syria, various sectors of the Syrian economy. They're talking about cutting off electricity supplies. They export perhaps about 10% of Syria's needs, but most people think Syria could make that up. They could also hit cooperation in the oil sector, and that's something other Arab countries are looking at. But realistically, nobody thinks these sanctions are going to change the direction of the regime of President Assad immediately. I think this is more of an expression of displeasure and a demonstration of its international isolation.
You've got the Arab League coming out against Assad and others now. Is this the last straw?
I think it's the last straw for Syria's international position, although, of course, Iran remains a key supporter and the Russian government is still resisting stronger international action. But the country is very isolated. The government's very isolated. The key thing is whether international diplomacy can stop the conflict, persuade the government to do some kind of deal, or whether Syria slips into a civil war, which, frankly, none of its neighbors can control.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Istanbul. Jonathan, thank you.
Good to talk to you, Steve.
Well, now to famine-ridden Somalia, there are new reports that tally an increasing flow of refugees to Kenya, almost 9,000 a month. And in refugee camps, there's a new economy emerging where Somalis get food, medicine, and money from relatives through their cell phones. From the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Just past the kids, the goats, and the camels at this refugee camp, there's a shack that says Safaricom. Cell phone store. A refugee steps to the counter, fiddles with a cheap Nokia, walks out with $16.
This man withdrew 1,500 shillings.
The store manager explains, this refugee just got money from a relative via cell phone, and just now he cashed out. All you need is a text message and a PIN number. Out of every 10 people here, 5 live on a dollar a day, 3 have electricity, 7 do mobile money.
The potential for mobile phones is absolutely fantastic.
That's John Hadanat at the International Food Policy Research Institute.
You can transfer money almost instantaneously, which cuts out a lot of the transactions costs. It's literally mobile money. They can take it and redeem it in lots of places.
Kenya's system is called M-Pesa, which is so common, it's a verb. As in, did you just M-Pesa while driving? Yes, my cabbie Peter just texted in a church tithe.
I'm almost like 500 kilometers from my home church. And the fundraiser is going to start at 11. I had to send a donation.
And in a minute, he gets a text.
Which has confirmed that I've sent...
I'll tell you what, you drive.
Turns out you can M-Pesa at the grocery store, pay utility bills, etc. So I join in.
How much?
1,200.
That's the starting price.
In Nairobi, I shop for a soccer jersey for my kid. And then out comes the phone.
Can I pay you M-Pesa?
Yeah, it's okay. No problem.
Okay. Now what? Enter the amount.
I text the seller $12 for the jersey, plus another 26 cents for the transaction. 20 seconds later, text message.
Yeah, I'm going to give you a text message.
Confirmed. Oh, cool. So you're Mr.
He gets his
Epster,
money, I get my shirt. It's that easy for farmers, herders, refugees all across Kenya. At the intersection of IT and development, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Now to a report, Steve, that came out today on which students hit the books hardest in college.
Yeah.
The National Survey of Student Engagement says engineering majors study the most, about 20 hours
Wait
per
a
week.
Second. There is a National Survey of Student Engagement.
That's right. Yeah, this is a very important
survey.
Oh, yeah,
the NSSE.
Yeah. I can't wait for this. Every year I wait for this survey to come out.
No.
Engineering majors, those are the biggest studiers, 20 hours per week.
You expect that.
Followed by science majors.
Right, of course.
Then those in the arts and humanities.
That was me. There
you go.
Yeah.
Then education.
Yeah.
Bottom of the list, Steve. Any guesses?
Let's see. Study. I can't. English major? No, that's arts and humanities.
Humanities.
Let me think. I have no idea.
Business majors.
Oh, well, of course.
And I guarantee you that they don't lose any salary as a result of studying the least as they get into their professional careers. Well, now to the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Spencer Backus, who is firing back after being accused of insider trading as part of a CBS 60 Minutes story. Backus says he never made trades based on knowledge that wasn't available to the general public.
Spencer Backus was one of the representatives from Alabama, a man that I used to cover and have talked to a few times. The 60 Minutes story spotlighted a lot of senators and representatives who have personally benefited from stocks they bought or sold based on information they learned in their job. But as Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, there's nothing illegal about it for members of Congress.
Lawmakers know before anyone else about government budgets, taxes, and regulations that can dramatically change stock prices. Maybe that's why senators' stock portfolios routinely outperform the market by 12%, according to Georgia State University's Alan Zabrowski. He says insider trading laws don't apply to Congress.
It's not illegal at all. There's absolutely nothing that prohibits members of Congress or their staffs from trading on information they pick up.
Zabrowski admits it would be difficult to police a ban on some congressional stock trading, but to give the rules teeth, he says members of Congress should have to immediately disclose what stocks they're buying and selling.
If the head of a banking committee starts unloading lots and lots of his bank stocks, the marketplace should be privileged to that information, and it'll make the market more efficient.
Zabrowski hopes the new momentum behind reforms will help get rid of the perception that some lawmakers vote to benefit their own stock portfolios. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well, at the NASDAQ exchange this morning, the co-founder of Angie's List rang the opening bell. That consumer review website, which, by the way, lost $40 million last year, goes public today. From Silicon Valley, Marketplace's Steve Henn looks into its business model.
Angie's List has been around the block. It's older than Google. It began before the first internet bubble inflated, way back in 1995. It's even shown up on game shows.
There's Craigslist and Her List, named for Ms. Hicks, who was frustrated when trying to find a good contractor. Tom,
what is Angie's List?
Yes.
At first blush, its business model seems kind of brilliant. Angie's List bundles up and sells consumer reviews. It doesn't pay the reviewers a dime, but today more than a million people subscribe to Angie's List for $30 to $60 a year. The company makes even more money by allowing well-reviewed businesses to advertise. So how is it that Angie's List is still in a hole?
They're spending a lot in marketing.
Nick Einhorn is with Renaissance Capital. He says the company spends around $80 on marketing to sign up a single new subscriber. Einhorn says the question for investors is whether all that spending will ever pay off. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
So the National Book Award winners were announced in New York last night, Steve. Since 1950, the National Book Foundation has honored authors for their work each year. And last night, the prize was given out in four categories: fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and young people's literature.
Yeah, and last night's winners might still be feeling the glow from their win. But do winning awards like this really pay off? And that's a question we're going to ask in our Midday Extra today. Does winning awards help an author's career? And here to talk with us this morning is Harold Augenbraum, who is the executive director of the National Book Foundation, and he's with us right now. Hi, Harold.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for being with us. I know when an author wins as kind of a prize, Maybe there's a bit of a groundswell. Maybe there's a bit of an uptick in sales.
Well, I think there are probably two ways to look at it when you talk about sales. And I early on in my career here, I called an author, I think it was my second year, and I called an author after the sales figures had come in. And he usually sold about 18,000 copies in hardcover of his book. And after a month or so, after winning the National Book Award, he had sold 65,000 hardcovers of his book. So I called him and I said, you know, isn't this fabulous? You know, you've sold, you know, many times what you would have sold had you not won the National Book Award. And he paused and he said to me, you know, for me, Harold, it's not about sales. It's about audience. So when you say to me that it sold 65,000 books, it means to me that tens of thousands more people are going to read my work. So, you know, I'm assuming that he was very happy that he sold a lot more books in the sense that he made more money.
Yeah, I'm sure he wasn't sad about it.
And, you know, he was able to, you know, go on a better vacation that year. But, yeah, I think that the main thing for the authors is that suddenly, depending on who they are, they get a much larger audience.
Who are the people, Harold, that pay attention to the National Book Award prizes? I mean, who goes out and buys a book because of something like this?
I don't want to say general readers. I think probably because it's a literary award, people who go out there and buy them are people who want a little bit of direction on what their reading is going to be. Not necessarily that they drink the Kool-Aid, that they take these recommendations and say this must be a good book because five peer authors said that it's a great book. But they'll read it, and most of the time they'll either say, yes, it is a great book, or they'll say, nah, it's not that great, or they'll get halfway through and they'll throw it against the wall.
You know, it's interesting, Harold, because one of the staples of reading, like early in life, or especially in high school, To Kill a Mockingbird. I remember picking that up and having to read it in high school, and great book. And then later in life, I realized, wow, it won the Pulitzer Prize. You know, it's one of those things where it was like it sort of cemented the value of that book in my mind. And I'm sure the National Book Award is the same way.
I think so. I mean, I think it probably has, you know, for some people it can have a mixed blessing. I mean, there's this wonderful opening chapter of Saul Bellow's Humboldt's Gift, where his main character, Charlie Citrine, wins the Pulitzer Prize and realizes when he wakes up the next morning that he will forever be known, and on his tombstone it will say, Pulitzer Prize winner, Charlie Citrine. Yeah. So that it becomes a book that, you know, for, let's take To Kill a Mockingbird as an example, it becomes a book that, for better or worse, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel.
Right, right.
It doesn't change the work, but I think it changes the consumption of the work in retrospect.
Harold, let me ask you one more question. You know, there are a lot of journalists in our field who get really obsessed with winning prizes, and that's all they want to do. They want to do one story in the course of a year so they can go out and win a prize and put it on their resume and maybe put it on their tombstone, as you say. do authors, do you think, write books specifically for that purpose, that they want to be a prize winner, and it's not about necessarily what they want to do for the audience? It's that they want to go out and win this prize.
I would really question the fact that you can write a book in order to win a prize. I mean, I guess it's possible, but if people do that, I would bet that they fail 99% of the time. So if you're going to do that and, you know, write a book to win a prize, 999 times out of 1,000, you're going to fail.
Harper Lee wrote one book.
I'm not sure that she wrote it for the Pulitzer Prize.
But she wrote one book. She didn't follow it up, I tell you that much.
Turn around and say to Truman Capote, you know, I want to win a Pulitzer Prize. I'm going to write To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah. It was all a secret plan.
Yes. I mean, it's sort of, you know, if that were the case, I think I'm just, today's my last day in my job. I think I'm going to go out and start writing a National Book Award winner tomorrow.
Harold Augenbraum, Executive Director of the National Book Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Harold.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and finally this morning, Neiman Marcus, Jeremy, has been dazzling wishlisters for more than 100 years with its annual Christmas offering, its catalog. You've seen that catalog before,
yep,
right?
Yep,
it's got
sure.
all kinds of highfalutin things,
$45,000 right? Oh, yeah. Yurt.
I think there's a Ferrari in there this year. It goes for like $395.
Yeah, that's
grand.
Where I'd buy all my Christmas gifts.
This year, you're going to have to pay, though, to see that Book of Dreams.
Of course.
Yeah, the luxury retailer is charging $15 just to get a copy of the catalog in order to buy something from the catalog. Now, they do say that it's refundable if you buy something from in the book.
Okay,
like, say, a speedboat handcrafted right here in the U.S., complete with gold accoutrement that goes for $250,000.
If you do that, then you get the $15 back.
Yeah, so the boat would only be, let's see,
$249,985.
But hurry, because there are only 10 speedboats that they made. So you have to
I'll get right on
one.
That, Steve. Yeah. I'm right on top of that, Steve. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Thursday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.